we can learn quite a bit from what we thought several years ago, how events transpired and how countries reacted to inform our thinking on what might be coming in the years ahead.
Welcome to Vox Dev Talks. My name is Tim Phillips. Unorthodox policies for unorthodox times. That was the title of the first in a series of five blogs that was published by the International Growth Center in 2018. At the time, the authors argued that the environment for development had changed, and so development policies should be changing too. Well, it's 7 years on, and this week, as 3,000 of the people who formulate and implement those policies are gathering in Davos for the 2025 annual meeting with the World Economic Forum, how prescient was the analysis in these articles? And what could this mean for future growth policy? But we've got both of the authors of those blogs with us today. Tim Doberman of the London School of Economics, also Research Director of the IGC. Tim, welcome.
Thank you, Tim.
And Francesco Caselli of London School of Economics as well. Francesco, hello.
Hello.
What was it, Francesco, that was happening in 2018 that inspired you to write these articles?
Being at the LSE, both Tim and I were occasionally called to talk to governments, especially for developing countries, and give them some perspective and views about how to think about development policy and how to try to improve situations in their countries. And I think around that time, we were finding ourselves tweaking the things we were saying and changing a bit the story we were giving to them. And it was almost happened automatically as we were reacting to news and changes in the world. And at some point we said, wait a minute, we are really systematically changing things that we are saying here. Maybe it's a time to stop and chat and think and try to understand why we are modifying the standard advice and what is causing us to do that. And if we look at what was beginning to happen in 2018, that was changing the way we were thinking about the priorities for developing countries. It was mostly about changes in the global economic and geopolitical environment. Increasing trade tensions, fragmentation in the trade environment. 2016, you have Brexit, you have the election of Donald Trump, who tends to voice skepticism about the importance of trade. You have tensions, again, between the U.S. and Russia, U.S. and China, U.S. and Iran. The U.S. Beginning to voice skepticism about NATO, and so also a sense of geopolitical tensions there. You have the acceleration in automation, which has implications for the viability of trade for some developing countries. There was a whole range of trends that we thought might warrant a rethinking of some of the standard recommendations that IGC and other organizations give to developing countries.
You wrote that the times were unorthodox. Were you advocating big changes to policy in response or tweaks to policy?
It was actually the departure from the conventional political and economic order. That's what we felt was unorthodox. It wasn't the comfortable 1990s, early 2000s, or you can call it the Washington Consensus. For the reasons that Francesco highlighted, you had disintegration in trade, geopolitical tensions, regional conflicts, the aftermath of the Arab Spring that had really fizzled out and created lasting conflict in some countries like Syria. And then these undercurrents of rapid technological change and climate change as well. And I'll add, in our initial conversation, Francesco at some point ended with the loose quote of, "I've never been so worried in my life," to paraphrase. So I think that's what we felt was unorthodox. It felt quite different, the set of challenges, and in many ways, the combination of challenges all at once. So what did that mean for policies and development thinking? In many ways, it was adjustments on the conventional wisdom. It's not perhaps full departures of what we think development should be or should involve. We very much focused on the fundamentals. So things like the human capital or the education of the workforce, the importance of having functioning institutions. So those elements are only strengthened. But on the margin, it's areas like, should we immediately try to leap into export-led manufacturing as the way to achieve growth? If you're Rwanda today, is that the right avenue? Or even in 2018, was that the right avenue? Given that there's these concerns around the ability to enter these global value chains as easily, a lot of it is really just thinking about how do we need to adjust the conventional growth dialogues in a way that better reflects what we felt was unorthodox about the current political and economic order.
To pick up on the example Tim gave, I think that may be one of our calls that proved particularly right, which is the fragility of a strategy for development based on jumping on a global value chain. So the traditional approach that you are developing countries, you have a lot of low education labor, you want to jump on the lower rung of the ladder of the global value chain as a way of getting on the ladder and getting the process starting. And then as you start earning wages from that, then you can start improving the human capital of your labor force through education, to improvement in health, and ride up this ladder. We said then that that strategy looked less promising at the time, and I think that was a right call. All those trends that we were worried about then have proven possibly even more severe than we anticipated.
Before we go into looking at where we are today, there's one more thing. Tim, you mentioned climate change. Rereading what you wrote about climate change, the warnings that if we do not take action immediately, that there will be substantial damages. It's very much the same warnings as we will be hearing from the World Economic Forum this week. Have we wasted 7 years when we could have been taking action and adjusting policies?
Yeah, it's a concerning thought that we might have lost a lot of precious time. Last year, again, the World Meteorological Organization declared 2024 as the hottest year on record.
Yeah.
Based on the Copernicus satellite from the EU, we've now officially breached the 1.5 degrees Celsius warming target, which was the aspirational goal of the Paris Climate Agreement in 2015. So in many ways, we perhaps have not made the progress we would have hoped. One thing hasn't changed, which is that the science has been very clear, and it's only become clear. I think in 2018, the implications of climate change for not only economic activity, but well-being of society were very clear. The consequences were grave and pretty understood. Perhaps the magnitudes were just slightly being adjusted. But I think what has become more evident over this period is the need to take this more seriously and integrate this into development policy. And having this not just be a precondition to getting kind of financing or other international support, it's really accepted now as a reality. And I think that's been one change. How the shape of development policy has really embodied this.
We don't often take the opportunity to look back as we're doing today. Why is it a good idea to do that now?
Tim, ask me.
I think it's interesting to get a sense of these big global trends, whether it's technology, geopolitics, conflict. What really does that mean for the evolution of developing country in their growth story? And we can learn quite a bit from what we thought several years ago, how events transpired and how countries reacted to inform our thinking on what might be coming in the years ahead. A lot of what we had touched on in these initial articles were pretty good in terms of capturing the form of what some of these issues might mean. So we predicted that there would be greater tensions on trade. We thought there might be, you know, spillovers in terms of having greater conflict, which would disrupt the ability for countries to easily engage kind of either geopolitically or economically as well. In the lens of reimagining growth in the next years ahead, where we have these new realities, and I think we could argue that many of our worst fears have either hardened or been realized. Some of them have taken a different form. Some of them were completely unpredicted by us, like the COVID-19 global pandemic and the impact on supply chains. But I think this is an interesting moment to reevaluate. If we had to write this again, would we give the same advice?
Back then, these were tentative guesses at new trends, and we were very careful in framing our thoughts about the implication for developing policy. And I think we used the word tweaks, indicating that these were not massive changes to the way you should think about developing policy. But because pretty much all of these trends have continued to become stronger and stronger, and in some of these cases, surprise us by becoming even stronger than we thought they might, I think at this time, maybe it's time to upgrade these from tweaks to fairly major considerations in designing policy.
Let's have a look at these trends one by one to see where you guessed right and where, as you say, it exceeded what we imagined at the time. Obviously, geopolitical fragmentation is a good place to start. Has this widespread breakdown in cooperation exceeded your prediction? What alarms does this sound for you?
I would describe it as hitting roughly the central prediction. At the time, we might have had a range of expectations about this. And I think we were worried that the cooperation between the major powers would become more and more fractious and eventually collapse. And that has happened. We might not have predicted a major war in Europe, but overall, geopolitical tensions between the US and China, US and Russia, US and Iran, and many other intersecting ingredients, I think, have happened. The idea that developing countries need to think about trying to survive in a world where there is a lot of conflict, and sometimes the conflict is at their doorstep, which all the implications with disruptions in trade, migration flows, disruption in financial flows, I think that's absolutely become quite important. And I don't think you can think about policy in a developing country without putting that very high among the list of things to worry about.
Okay, how does this geopolitical shift from a unipolar world to a bipolar world affect a developing country? One aspect might be basic security. So if you look at West Africa, there's been a void almost with concerns on, say, French involvement in providing security to the state versus Russian involvement. So you've seen a lot of collapse in state security in Western Africa with military coups. You could think about the availability of financing, whether this means financing from China or financing from other multilateral institutions. Suddenly, there is a political bent towards this, and that can affect the set of decisions that you can make and the considerations that you should make when you're factoring in these decisions. And the third one is trade.
Yeah.
On trade, it actually could even open up opportunities. If you're a country that happens to be adjacent or nearby China, you might benefit from tensions around large Chinese manufacturing exports into Europe or the United States. Let's take the example of China's solar panel manufacturing industry. As a result of huge import tariffs to prevent effectively dumping of Chinese solar panels in Europe or the United States or elsewhere, a lot of Chinese businesses have been now outsourcing and outshoring their production to countries like Vietnam or Malaysia. This has opened up completely new opportunity for these countries, going against what we were saying, but in this case, export-led manufacturing by entering a different global value chain. It's interesting to think in general how these types of political interactions at the global level obviously affect negatively the opportunities for growth, but could actually create some unique opportunities for certain countries to exploit.
I agree with Tim, and I think that actually there is evidence that the Trump tariff from the first administration did create the opportunity that Tim is talking about for some countries that China used to bypass the tariffs. My worry about that is that I don't know how persistent that opportunity can be, because if there is retrenchment from trade and the desire to reduce imports of manufacturing, then it won't take long before say, a U.S. administration picks up that China is using third countries as a way to bypass the tariffs. And so it's not difficult to imagine a situation where they extend the tariffs to these other countries or just increase the tariffs across the board to all other countries. So for now, that might seem like an option, but I wouldn't want to put all my eggs in that basket.
I can't criticize you for not predicting COVID-19. Has that changed things completely, or did it just get us to where we were going in these impacts on trade a bit quicker?
I actually have a slightly different view on COVID than the one you're implying.
Mm-hmm.
I feel that COVID is a different type of shock, which, if anything, has taught us to appreciate trade and opportunity to trade internationally. I think it has suggested to us that we can insure each other to some extent. So imagine a country that experiences a very severe shock to its supply, say because of a lockdown. Then, because pandemics hit different countries at different times and to different extents, actually trade is a way that we can cushion the effect of the pandemic on our own supply. We can try to source abroad what we cannot produce at home because we are all locked down at home. It should have reminded us that we're losing quite a bit from retrenching on trade. It's this mutual insurance property of trade.
A beneficial legacy, if you can ever say that, about the pandemic is in terms of the effect that the shock had, if you think about the rapid adoption now of digital payments. That is a global trend which we've seen, perhaps everywhere except my own country, Germany. If you look at India, if you look throughout Africa, mobile money has really taken off. And again, I won't do a cause and effect here, but it's certainly, I think, expedited the adoption of these types of technologies. And that creates unique opportunities for things like financing or improving remittances. I think another area, and this is where IGC did quite a lot of work during the pandemic, is on social protection and rapid response. It forced governments to really build up social protection systems if they didn't have them or reinforce them where they were weak to ensure the ability to do things like vaccine delivery, especially in rural areas. We had a large portfolio of work on this, in particular in Sierra Leone. And so the hope is that, you know, God forbid, if there's another pandemic, that the systems that have been built in response for this pandemic can really result in a wider institutional improvement in how some of these governments can deliver healthcare services. So that is the optimistic spin, perhaps, of what the pandemic may have done.
Another that was then, this is now thought that occurred to me when I was rereading what you wrote in 2018 was when we discussed automation at the time, it was very much about robots, industry, manufacturing as the impact of automation. Of course, now we're all talking about AI, which has a much wider impact. Has that changed the way in which we should start thinking about policy in this area?
Clearly, AI was the biggest new trend that we missed in 2018. Actually, I was thinking, you know, it just tells you something about just the insane speed at which AI is developing.
Mm-hmm.
It got barely a mention in 2018. And now it's possibly the most important determinant of future developments globally. It's just incredible how fast that is happening. In terms of the qualitative economic analysis of the implications of AI, I don't think qualitatively it's that different from automation. It's basically a way of replacing labor. Automation tended to mostly replace low education, low skill labor. AI allows you to replace many more types of labor, possibly one day all types of labor, but, you know, clearly working its way up the education or skill distribution. But in terms of the implications for development strategy, is similar in the sense that it's going to continue to make cheaper and cheaper for high-income countries to reshore, to produce domestically, whether it's manufacturing, whether it's services, because it's going to make all tasks increasingly cheap and reduce the need or the advantage to use cheaper labor abroad. So in terms of saying, look, just jumping on the global value change is your way out of underdevelopment, that's unlikely to work as well anymore. I think that's strongly reinforced that insight we had in 2018. The combination of AI and automation really makes it very hard to see countries following the path of China or other countries who have ridden the global value change in this way. Think about a world where growth comes from within and where it's very likely that your main market will be the domestic market or possibly the regional market, but not so much the US or Europe or Japan.
A lot of the focus is rightfully on labor market impacts of AI, of whether that's potentially positive productivity boost, but also the disruptive effects that this might have across the income distribution. Another angle on how AI can be used for things like services delivery. AI can be used to improve the functioning of institutions. So IGC is supporting some work, for instance, on using AI to improve the judicial efficiency of courts in India, where there's a huge backlog of cases. And a lot of it is really just due to quite rote mechanical delays that are preventing cases from being processed. You can also think of AI being applied in a beneficial way for things like precision agriculture or providing access to credit. So it's an interesting tension because it's a technology that can provide immense positive benefits to the functioning of the state, to the functioning of economies, but also if not managed well. And I think we're only beginning to really grasp how disruptive it can be for the labor markets.
I want you to tell me about what policies you think should be on the agenda now in 2025 in places like Davos, based on the topics that you raised in 2018. First of all, employment, the future of work. Can we still predict that if we have growth, it will produce employment, good jobs?
So my sense is that the nature of where job creation will come from will inherently be quite different. Mm-hmm. There is still a bias towards thinking that manufacturing is the most plausible sector for job creation. I'm not denying that this is certainly a possibility in many instances, but I think what we're seeing in our countries and in our conversations with policymakers is an increasing interest in examining what the role of services might be in creating jobs. I think a lot of what the historical structural transformation literature is focused on, maybe at a surface level, is really a sectoral shift from agriculture to manufacturing, then eventually to skilled services. But as you've rightfully alluded to, I think a lot of this is really about good jobs. And with these technologies, for instance, the ability to have a good job in services might be more feasible than in the past. And so I think it's still actually an open question whether you can see the same degree of job creation and productivity growth in services as you've seen historically in manufacturing. But there are certainly examples like India that demonstrate it can be done.
In geopolitics, where can countries look for allies in this more fragmented world?
I think they should look first to themselves. Tim reminded me earlier that I said I never been so worried. I am more worried now than I was then. And I think some of the basics that we might have wanted to take for granted a while ago, they're not going to be necessarily there. I think as basic as food security. I would worry about food security because of trade, because of conflict, because of climate change. You can think about all the beautiful development strategies or industrial policy in the world, but if you have a famine, that's going to set you back decades. So don't have a famine, my first advice. And I think that's getting quite non-trivial to achieve because of all those simultaneous trends. Don't get a war. Don't get invaded. All these things are no longer things that you can take for granted. But if any of the things happen to you, forget about having higher living standard for the next generations because you won't. And so I will start from there.
Now, it's unfair for me to say, can you recommend climate policies in 1 minute? But are there opportunities that you could see in 2018 that haven't been taken up so far that are still available in 2025 for coping with or mitigating the climate crisis?
This is what's completely infuriating about climate policy failures, because the technological progress in green energy in particular has been way, way, way faster than I would have expected. And I think most people would have expected. Solar, wind, you name it. The rate at which cost of producing this energy have declined has exceeded our rosiest expectation. And so, you know, when you were talking to the team earlier about if we miss an opportunity, yes, we have a gigantic opportunity, because the economic costs of the green transition, if we had been serious about it, would have been much, much lower than we thought they might be. And so it's incredibly discouraging that hasn't happened. Having said that, those much lower costs and better technologies are there. And so at least in principle, the opportunity is still there. The problem that I see is that climate change has pretty much fallen off the political discussion. If you look at 2018 and you went to Davos, say, people will be speaking about climate change most of the time. You know, there would be a very, very high focus. And I predict, I hope I'm wrong, but I predict that this year we will barely hear about climate change at Davos.
I think this topic is so important, so I will do damage to the podcast listenership by extending my answer by 1 minute. So if you are going to click off, do not click off.
Do not click off.
Do not click off, please. There's so many opportunities. I think we've been using this language, the opportunity of sustainable growth, at IGC. We've written a white paper on innovation, growth, and the environment, because we see so many innovations technological, like Francesco has said. The cost of solar, wind, and batteries are basically falling 20% for every doubling of capacity, and there's no indication that this trend is slowing down anytime soon. There's also been innovations in institutional design, market design, you name it, that have weakened this notion of a trade-off between economic growth and minimizing the harms on the environment. So I would say just briefly, 2 points on that. Number one, there's a lot of interest in the role of the state. So what can governments be doing to steer and energize this transition? I think that is very much now back in the mainstream, which perhaps was less so 10 years ago. And secondly, how can we make sure these innovations diffuse around the world? So there's so much progress. A real concern is if we have geopolitical tensions, if we have trade disintegration, that some of the countries that need these innovations most will have a harder time to get them. Whether that's being shut out of markets, being priced out of markets because the cost of capital is so high, you name it. But those are some of the real, real concerns.
Partly due to COVID, partly due to other factors that have happened in the last 7 years, there is less fiscal space. Now, to do anything ambitious in policy, how much does this constrain the countries that we're talking about?
I have a very cynical view about this. Financial markets go through cycles. They lend you, probably lend you too much. Then you default. Then you are shut out for a couple of years. And then financial markets start lending you again. I always thought, go for it. The opportunities for borrowing are still there. The cost of things not going so well and having to default are not that long-lived. I thought then in 2018, I still think today, that it's worth taking advantage of financial markets and try to use that to finance government spending.
So if you could sit down next to your 2018 self, would you find that you are more optimistic or less optimistic about the future for development policy?
I am a grumpy old man, so I should leave the younger, optimistic member of the team to take this.
I am unchanged. I was optimistic then, and I will remain optimistic now that we can come up with a world free of poverty with room for nature. So I'm very optimistic.
We will be back in 7 years. So what does that take us to? 2032, where I will speak to both of you. And hopefully we can be saying, what were we so worried about for today? Thank you very much for talking about it, Francesco.
Thank you very much.
And Tim as well.
It's a pleasure. Thanks.
If you want to go back to the source material, those blogs were published in September and October 2018. If you go to igc.org and search for Unorthodox Policies for Unorthodox Times, then you'll find them. This has been a Vox Dev Talk. The best way to make sure you don't miss an episode, subscribe. You'll find us wherever you get your podcasts. Our past episodes, as always, are at voxdev.org. where you will also find articles about the topics we feature. If you like what you're hearing, please leave us a review. Tell someone else about us.